Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Over the past few years, tens of thousands of Central American teenagers have fled their countries, often as unaccompanied minors, to seek asylum here in the U.S. One of the communities with a high concentration of Guatemalan teenagers is the Chicago suburb of Bensonville. There, many of the teenagers, some as young as 13 and 14, spend their days as students in school and then their evenings as laborers in dangerous factories, working long shifts to pay off debts to their smugglers and sponsors and send money home to the families they left behind. Some only have just an hour or two to sleep in between school and work. Joining us now to bring us inside the lives of some of these immigrant teenagers is Melissa Sanchez. She is a reporter for ProPublica Illinois, and her recent piece is Inside the Lives of Immigrant Teens Working Dangerous Night Shifts in Suburban Factories. Hello, Melissa. Thank you for joining us today.
Hey, thank you for having me.
We also have with us Becky Morales. She is an EL, English language teacher at York Community High School in Elmhurst, Illinois, which serves Bensonville and is where many of these Guatemalan teenagers attend school. Hello, Becky. Welcome to the 21st.
Thank you for having me.
And listeners, I want to mention that given the school schedules, we pre-taped this conversation, so our phone lines are not open, but as always, we'd love to hear your thoughts. You can tweet us at 21st Show or email us talk@21stshow.org. Melissa, I want to begin with you. In your reporting, you spoke with 15 of these teenagers in Bensonville. Can you paint a picture for us? Who are they? What are they coming here seeking?
Sure. So the vast majority of these kids who I met live in the same apartment complex on the south side of Bensonville. And it's a pretty large complex that's home to, I'd say, hundreds of families from the same part of Guatemala, a state called Huehuetenango. And these kids, like you said at the start, a lot of them came alone as unaccompanied minors, and some came with parents or with other adult relatives. In the past, I'd say 5 or 6 years, some as recently as a year ago. And they came seeking all sorts of things. Some of them came for economic reasons. Some of them came escaping gang violence. Others came trying to leave domestic violence at home. Some were beaten by their parents or left orphaned. And they had all sorts of reasons for leaving, like we've heard over the past several years with the crisis of kids at the border. But they wound up here in the U.S. But their travel from Guatemala to here wasn't free. They had to pay somebody, or their families had to pay somebody to smuggle them in. And so when they come, they can't just start a brand new life and, you know, become like an American high school kid. They have to first pay off their debts that they left behind, and then earn their keep, whether they're with relatives or with a family friend. They often have to pay their share of the rent, etc. So these kids, who some of them are very tiny looking children, wind up having these double lives of being a high school kid during the day and then at night taking on jobs through temp agencies at factories all over the suburbs. It's a pretty grueling existence.
In your story, you describe one of the teenagers who goes by Garcia, who left his family when he was 15. His family had to take out a loan and use their home as collateral to pay for the smugglers to guide him across Mexico from Guatemala. What is that journey like?
For him, luckily, it wasn't too bad. Sometimes the journey can be really dangerous. So in his case, by the time they made the decision and got the money and paid the coyote, it was within a couple of weeks that he was on a bus leaving Guatemala. He mostly rode buses and vehicles through Mexico. There was one part in Mexico City that he told me about where something happened and according to him, some Mexican police officers ended up intercepting the group that he was traveling with, and they had to wait outside for a day or two until their coyotes could come back. One of the coyotes might have gotten beaten in that process, but eventually all the people who were being smuggled were okay. And they were able to continue on their way. I talked to other kids who had much more harrowing experiences. One boy talked about how he had to travel in the back of a semi-trailer with, he guesses, 100 or more people were inside. And it was a really cramped, dark, hot place where people were, you know, doing their basic necessities in the back of this truck for several days. And they were thirsty and hungry. They eventually made it over. He thinks some of them got sick and were dizzy and would pass out, but he made it okay. It can range for the kids.
Yeah, that sounds terrible. What when they do come here? I mean, you're describing children, right? And we're supposed to have labor laws against children working in this country. How are they getting around those child labor laws?
Yeah, so that's the complicated part. So they are using fake IDs to get jobs. The IDs say that they're 21 or 22, even though they're as young as 13 or 14 when they're working, and they look like they're 13 or 14 or younger. But they're doing the same thing that a lot of undocumented immigrants in this country do to get work, and temp workers in particular. So factory jobs in the Chicago suburbs are largely temped out. That means there's agencies acting kind of as a go-between the factory and the worker. And there's agencies where it's pretty well established that regardless of your immigrant status here, you can show up and get a job. And the quality of the paperwork doesn't really matter a whole lot. And in this case, I just want to make clear that these kids aren't undocumented. They came in here seeking asylum. So whether their asylum cases are still pending or not, they did come in with like legal entry. But I was just making the comparison with other undocumented.
That's a good point. Becky, I want to bring you into the conversation now. Becky Morales, you work with many of these students at York Community High School, and I want to get to that one particular student, Garcia, in a moment. But first, can you talk about how it is working with these students in general? How is their performance in school affected by these late shifts in factories?
Yeah, definitely. So a lot of my students work about half of them in factories and about half in restaurants. Nonetheless, they're all very long hours. And of course, balancing that with being in school for 6 to 7 hours really leaves them with little time for sleep or exercise or anything fun. In one of my classes, I had about 17 kids in the class, and I had about half of them working in factories. All of the students, though, in my classes, in my intermediate English classes, are what we call in the education world SLIFE or SIFE. It's students who have interrupted formal education, interrupted or limited, because they have gaps in their education. So perhaps they left elementary school around, you know, fourth or fifth grade. I have one who left in third grade, and they were working in Guatemala for a while. And then when they decided to come to the United States, they were maybe middle school age, they might have started working for a couple years, or they might have entered into our school system. And so they missed a chunk of school in the middle. So the students that we have in our classes they have very low literacy levels, the majority, and low math skills. And we're trying to get them caught up, right, with just kind of doing school, right? Like we need to teach school routines and raising hands and kind of teach them how we do school in the United States, because of course each education system is different. It's a lot of support that's required to help them catch up. And then in addition, many of our students have suffered trauma or they face multiple challenges outside of school, like what we're talking about. And all of that affects their social emotional learning in school. So we have interrupted education, we have that we're catching them up on, we have some trauma backgrounds, and then we also have the lack of sleep, just sleep deprived, that they are working so many hours. So there's so many different factors going into my students' lives.
I'm going to quickly reintroduce you. This is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're talking about a recent story from ProPublica Illinois called Inside the Lives of Immigrant Teens Working Dangerous Night Shifts in Suburban Factories. We're with the author of that piece, Melissa Sanchez, who's a reporter for ProPublica Illinois, and also Becky Morales, an English language teacher at York Community High School in Elmhurst, where a large number of Guatemalan teenager immigrants attend school by day and work by night in factories and restaurants, as we've heard. And listeners, you might be hearing some noise in the background. That is a rooster, we want to say. It's not, Becky is not at the school and there's no one sort of yelling in the background there. But one of the particularly poignant anecdotes in the story is about Garcia. And Becky, this is one of your students. You saw he came into class with a serious hand injury. Can you share that story?
Sure. I actually had him last year for three different periods. And so I had him during a resource period, which is like a study hall and then English class. And then I co-taught a chef's corner class, so a cooking class. So he had mentioned that he had hurt his hand at work during my English class. And I kind of looked at it. It was kind of bandaged up. And so I made a point that I was going to talk to him in between classes. And while we were walking to our cooking class, he explained that he works at a factory where he cleans cooking. It's a factory that produces some kind of food. And so he cleans the equipment with a very high pressure washer. And that night, because of course he got off work at 6 a.m., that night at work, he had the pressure hose had kind of nicked his hand, broke open the glove, and made a pretty deep cut in near his knuckle. And so he asked to go to the doctor, but since he didn't have papers or insurance, they said, you just have to clean up here. So he did the best he could, came home from work at 6 a.m., kind of got ready for school, came to school, and he was in pain and he had this hand injury. So when we got to the cooking class, I didn't want him, you know, cooking with the food. I said, let's look at this and see if we can clean this up a little bit better. So we got the first aid kit and I had him wash it and we put on some Neosporin, but it just looked a little too deep for this. So I sent him to the nurse. I kind of had to ask him many times. He really, really didn't want to go. I finally got him to go to the nurse. And I think when he went to the nurse, she tried to ask him what had happened, but he didn't really want to tell the whole story. And so she ended up just bandaging it. But even today, his knuckle is still kind of swollen and he still has problems kind of grasping things. So it was a much more serious injury than just a simple cut. And I wish I could have done more for it at the time.
Melissa, your piece dives into some of these complications of how child labor protections and sanctions are or are not really effective in these situations. You write, by and large, labor departments are complaint-based systems. If nobody complains, there is rarely proactive investigation or enforcement. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So for a lot of reasons, labor departments have been decimated all over the country. Illinois is no exception. And in the state labor department, when I presented them my findings, they were really interested in going after whatever factories or temp agencies are employing these kids. But the problem with this, the problem that kind of I struggled with as I reported this story, is that these kids don't see themselves as victims. So I spoke with four different kids who had gotten hurt in various ways, some really severely, and none of them feel like they've been exploited. None of them want to complain. None of them want the authorities to know what's going on because they're afraid of losing their ability to support themselves. They're afraid of getting deported. They're afraid that the relatives that they live with might go to jail if somebody finds out that they were allowed to work as minors. So for labor departments, which might have people sincerely interested in helping these kids or ensuring that child labor doesn't happen, it becomes an impossible situation because there might be children. There's probably hundreds or thousands of kids working in Illinois and across the country who are like Garcia. But if nobody's complaining, then where are they supposed to go? And that's sort of like the heart of the story, where it's hard because I think a lot of us can't imagine our own children working at night with dangerous machinery, getting hurt, and, you know, showing up sleep deprived to school. But these kids, and I should probably stop using that word, these young men, again, some of them are as young as 13, they don't see themselves as victims. So they don't want anybody to interrupt their lives. And that's what makes it impossible for any enforcement agency to do anything. And I think the larger point for me is that having the labor department go in and do something about child labor doesn't actually fix the problem. It's going to be like whack-a-mole. The kid's going to go find a job somewhere else because the underlying problem, which is poverty, which is their debt, which is the circumstances that brought them into this country with financial need, haven't gone away. And so what we need is a solution that's more systemic. And the labor department by itself can't do that.
Yeah, and we've only got about a minute left, unfortunately. But Melissa, what do activists and advocates say? I mean, you've laid out such a complicated, nuanced set of issues with a very difficult balancing act. What are people looking to have done, at least in the short term, to try and deal with these problems?
I mean, in the short term, I mean, like, I know Becky's heard from a lot of people who want to help financially with these individual kids. It doesn't fix the larger system. I think to start, maybe just an acknowledgement that this is happening. We paid a lot of attention to the crisis at the border of all the Central Americans. And we have never asked ourselves what happened to these kids after they made it in the U.S. And so they're here now. And I think maybe what this reporting can help us do is to start to rethink, like, how are our school systems handling them? Like, what supports do the school systems need? Immigration court isn't really paying attention to where the kids are going or how their well-being is. And labor departments too. So I think it's just a starting point. Nobody that I've talked to has any solutions. But I think we just need to start talking about it more.
And I think we're going to have to leave it there. I want to thank Melissa Sanchez, who's a reporter at ProPublica Illinois, and Becky Morales, a teacher at York Community High School in Elmhurst. Thank you both so much for joining us to talk about this important story.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up after the break, actor, writer, and Northern Illinois University alum Mary Holland, plus the Great Conjunction. This is the 21st. Stay with us.